I say unto you, lecture number 11, 2nd of November 1977, at the Bhagwan Shivajni's ashram, Pune.
Bhagwan, Jesus went into the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning he came again into the temple. And all the people came unto him, and sat down, and taught them. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery, in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. What sayest thou? This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself, and said unto them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast stone at her. And again he stooped down, and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had lifted himself up, and saw none but the woman, he said unto her, Woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? She said, No man, Lord. And Jesus said unto her, Neither do I condemn thee. Go, and sin no more.
Religion always deteriorates into morality. Morality is dead religion. Religion is alive morality. They never meet. They cannot meet. Because life and death never meet. Light and darkness never meet. But the problem is, they look very alike. The corpse looks very like the living man. Everything is just like when the man was alive. The same face, the same eyes, the same nose, the hairs, the body. Just one thing is missing, and that one thing is invisible. Life is missing, but life is not tangible and not visible. So when a man is dead, he looks as if he is still alive. And with the problem of morality, it becomes more complex. Morality looks exactly like religion, but it is not. It is a corpse. It stinks of death. Religion is youth. Religion is freshness. Freshness of the flowers and the freshness of the morning dew. Religion is a splendor of the stars, of life, of existence itself. When religion is there, there is no morality at all. And the person is moral, but there is no morality. There is no idea of what morality is. It is just natural. It follows you as your shadow follows you. You need not carry your shadow. You need not think about your shadow. You need not look back again and again and see whether the shadow is following you still or not. It follows. Just like that morality follows a religious person. He never considers about it. He never deliberately thinks about it. It is his natural flavor. But when religion is dead, when life has disappeared, then one starts thinking about morality continuously. Consciousness has disappeared and conscience becomes the only shelter. Conscience is a pseudo-phenomenon. Consciousness is yours, conscience is borrowed. Conscience is of the society, of the collective mind. It is not arising in your own being. When you are conscious, you act rightly because your act is conscious. And the conscious act can never go wrong. When your eyes are fully open and there is light, you don't try to get through the wall. You go through the door. When there is no light, and your eyes are also not functioning well, naturally you grope in the dark. You have to think 1,001 times where the door is. To the left? To the right? Am I moving in the right direction? And you stumble upon the furniture and you try to get out through the wall. A religious person is one who has eyes to see, who has awareness. In that awareness, actions are naturally good. Let me repeat, naturally good. Not that you manage them to be good. Managed goodness is no more goodness at all. It is pseudo. It is pretension. It is hypocrisy. When goodness is natural, it's spontaneous. Just as trees are green and the sky is blue, so is the religious man moral. Completely unaware of his morality. Aware of himself, but unaware of his morality. Has no ideas that he is moral. That he is good. That what he is doing is right. Out of his awareness comes innocence. Out of his awareness comes the right act. On its own accord. It has not to be brought, it has not to be cultivated, it has not to be practiced. Then morality has a beauty, but it is no more morality. It is simply moral. In fact, it is just a religious way of living. But when religion has disappeared, then you have to manage it. Then you have to constantly think what is right and what is wrong. And how you are going to decide what is right and what is wrong? You don't have your own eyes to see. You don't have your own heart to feel. You are dead and dull. You don't have your own intelligence to go into matters. then you have to depend on the collective mind that surrounds you. Religiousness has one flavor. Whether you are Christian or Hindu or Mohammedan, it does not make any difference. A religious person is simply religious. He is neither Hindu nor Mohammedan nor Christian. But a moral person is not just moral. Either he is Hindu or Christian or Mohammedan or Buddhist. Because morality has to be learned from the outside. If you are born in a Buddhist country, in a Buddhist society, you will learn the Buddhist morality. If you are born in a Christian world, you will learn the Christian morality. You will learn from others. And you have to learn from others because you don't have your own insight. So morality is borrowed. It is social. It is mob. It comes from the masses. And from where it comes to the masses? From tradition. They have heard what is right and what is wrong, and they have carried it down the ages. It is being given from one generation to another. Nobody bothers whether it is a corpse. Nobody bothers whether the heart beats still. It goes on being given from one generation to another. It is dull, dead, heavy. It kills joy. It is a kill joy. It kills celebration. It kills laughter. It makes people ugly. It makes people heavy, monotonous, boring. But it has a long tradition. Another thing to be remembered, religion is always born anew. In Jesus, again, religion is born. It is not the same religion that was with Moses. It has not come from the Moses. It has no continuity with the past. It is utterly discontinuous with the past. It arises again and again. Just like a flower comes on the rose bush. It has nothing to do with the flowers that had come before on the rose bush. It is discontinuous. It comes on its own. It has no past, no history, no biography. For the moment it is there. And for the moment it is so beautifully there. So authentically there. For the moment it is so strong, so alive, and yet so fragile. In the morning sun it was so young. By the evening it will be gone. The petals will start falling down into the earth. From where they had come in the first place. And it will not leave any trace behind. If you come next day, it is no more there. And it has not left any marks. It has simply disappeared. As it has come out of nothingness, it has gone back to nothingness, to the original source. Just like that is religion. When it happens in a Buddha, it is fresh, young, like a rose flower. Then it disappears. It leaves no traces. Buddha has said, religion is like a bird flying in the sky. It leaves no footmarks. Then it happens in a Moses. It is fresh, young again. Then in Jesus, it is fresh and young again. And when it will happen to you, it will not have any continuity. It will not come from somebody else. Christ, Buddha, me. It will not come from anybody else. It will arise in you. It will bloom in you. It will be a flowering of your being. And then it will be gone. You cannot give it to anybody. It is not transferable. It cannot be given, cannot be borrowed. It is not a thing. Yes, if somebody wants to learn, it can be learned. If somebody wants to imbibe, it can be imbibed. When around a master a disciple learns, absorbs the vibes of the master, then too it is something that is happening within him. Maybe from the outside, he gets the challenge, the provocation, the call. But that which arises, arises in him, utterly in him. It does not come from the outside. It may be like you were not aware that you can sing. You had never tried. You have never thought about the possibility. Then one day you see a singer. And suddenly his song starts pulsating around you. And in a moment of awakening, you become aware that you have also got a throat and a heart. And now suddenly, for the first time, you become also aware that there has been a song hidden in you. And you release it. But the song comes from your innermost core. It arises from your being. Maybe the provocation, the call, came from the outside, but not the song. So the master is a catalytic agent. His presence provokes something in you. His presence does not function as a cause. See, the Zung is right in bringing a new concept to the Western world. It has existed in the East for centuries. The concept of synchronicity. There are things which happen as cause and effect. And there are things which don't happen as cause and effect. But just synchronicity. This idea has to be understood. Because this idea will help you to understand the difference between morality and religion. Morality is cause and effect. Your father, your mother has taught you something. They function as the cause. And then the effect goes on continuing in you. Then you will teach your children. You will become the cause. And the effect will continue in your children. But listening a singer, suddenly you start humming a tune. There is no cause and effect relationship. The singer is not the cause and you are not the effect. You have caused your effect yourself. You are both the cause and the effect. The singer functioned only as a remembrance. The singer functioned only as a catalytic agent. What has happened to me, I cannot give it to you. Not that I don't want to give it to you. No, because it cannot be given. Its very nature is such, it cannot be given. But I can present it to you. I can make it available to you. Seeing that it is possible, seeing that it has happened to another man, why not to me? Suddenly something clicks inside you. You become alert of a possibility. Alert of a door that is in you, but you were never looking at it. You had forgotten it. And something starts sprouting in you. I functioned as a catalytic agent, not as a cause. The concept of synchronicity simply says that one thing can start something somewhere without being a cause. They say that if in a room somebody plays sitar and another sitar is placed in the corner, and if the player is really a master, a maestro, the sitar that is just sitting there in the corner will start throbbing because of the other sitar being played in the room, the wife, the whole milieu. And the sitar that is just sitting there in the corner, nobody is playing it, nobody is touching it, you can see its strings vibrating, whispering. Something that is hidden is surfacing. Something that was not manifest is manifesting. Religion is synchronicity. Morality is causal. Morality comes from the outside. Religion arises in you. When religion disappears, there is only morality. And morality is very dangerous. First, you don't know yourself what is right. But you start pretending. The hypocrite is created. You start pretending, you start showing that whatsoever you are doing is right. You don't know what right is. And naturally, because you don't know, you can only pretend. From the back door, you will continue doing the same, that you know that it is right. From the back door, you will have another life. From the front door, another. From the front door, you may be smiling. And from the back door, you may be crying and weeping. From the front door, you will pretend to be a saint. And from the back door, you will be as sinner as anybody else. Your life will become split. This is what is creating schizophrenia in the whole human consciousness. You become two or many. Naturally, when you are two, there is constantly conflict. Naturally, when you are many, there is a crowd and much noise. And you can never settle in silence. You can never rest in silence. Silence is possible only when you are one. When there is nobody else within you. When you are one piece, not fragmented. Morality creates schizophrenia, split personalities, divisions. A moral person is not an individual. Because he is divided. Only a religious person is an individual. The moral person has a personality, but no individuality. Personality means persona, mask. And he has many personalities, not only one. Because he has to have many personalities around him. In different situations, different personalities are needed. With different people, different personalities are needed. To one, he shows one face. To another, he shows another face. One goes on changing faces. You watch and you will see how you go on changing faces every moment. Alone, you have one face. In your bathroom, you have one face. In the office, you have another. Have you observed the fact that in your bathroom you become more childish. Sometimes you can show the tongue to yourself in the mirror, or you can make faces, or you can hum a tune, sing a song, or you can even have a little dance in the bathroom. But while you are dancing or showing the tongue in the mirror, if you become aware your child is looking from the keyhole, you change, immediate change. The old face comes back, the father personality. This cannot be done before the child. Otherwise, what he will think? That you are also like him? So what about that seriousness that you show to him always? You immediately pull down another face. You become serious. The song disappears, the dance disappears, the tongue disappears. You are back into your so-called front door personality. Morality creates conflict in you because it creates many faces. And the problem is, when you have many faces, you tend to forget which is your original one. In so many faces, how can you remember which is your original one? The Zen masters say the first thing for a seeker is to know his original face, because only then something can start. Only the original face can grow. A mask cannot grow. A false face can have no growth. Growth is possible only to the original face, because the original has only life. So the first thing is to know what is my original face. And it is arduous, because there is a long queue of false faces. And you are lost in your false faces. And sometimes you may think, this is my original face. If you go deep into it, you will find this again is a false face. Maybe it is more ancient than the others, so it looks more original. The Zen masters say, if you really want to see your original face, you will have to go before birth. You will have to conceive what was your face before you were born. Or what will be your face when you are dead? Between birth and death, you have all kinds of false faces. Even the small child starts learning the pseudo tricks, diplomacies. Just a small child, maybe one day old, just out of the womb, starts learning. Because he sees, if he smiles, the mother feels very good. If he smiles, the mother gives immediately her breast to him. If he smiles, mother comes close, hugs him, pats him. He has learned a trick, that if he wants the mother to be close to him, if he wants to be hugged and kissed and talked to, he has to smile. Now the diplomacy is born, the politician is born. Whenever he wants the mother to pull close to him, he cannot call, he cannot talk, but he can smile. He can wait when she looks at him, he can smile. The moment he smiles, the mother comes running. Now whether he feels like smiling in this moment or not, that is not the point. He wants the mother. He wants to manipulate the mother. He has a trick, a strategy, a technique he has learned, a smile, and mother comes. Then he will go on smiling. And whenever he wants somebody to come close, he will smile. And this face will not be the true face. Your smiles are not true. Your tears are also not true. Your whole personality is synthetic. Plastic. The so-called moralist has many personalities but no individuality. The religious person has individuality, no personality. He is one. His taste is always one. Buddha is reported to have said, "Taste me from anywhere and you will find the same taste as you taste the sea. From this side, from that side, from this shore, from that shore. Taste the sea from anywhere and it is salty." And Buddha says, "So is my taste. Taste me while I am asleep. Taste me while I am awake. Taste me when somebody is insulting me. Taste me when somebody is praising me." You will always find the same taste, the taste of a Buddha. The religious person is an individual. Second thing to be remembered, the moralist is always making efforts to impose his morality on others for many reasons. First, he uses his morality to manipulate himself. Naturally, he does the same to others. He starts using his morality to manipulate others. He uses morality for his own strategies, diplomacies. Naturally, he learns a trick that if he can enforce his morality on others, then things will be easier. For example, if the moralist speaks truth, his truth is not very deep. Deep down, there are only lies and lies. But at least he pretends in the society that he speaks the truth. He will try to impose his truth on others also. He would like everybody else to speak truth, because he will be very much afraid if somebody lies and tricks him, deceives him. And he knows that he himself is lying and deceiving people in subtle ways, but on the surface he keeps truth. And he goes on shouting, "Everybody should be true." He is very much afraid. He knows just like as he is deceiving others, the others may be deceiving him. Bertrand Russell has said that thieves are always against stealing. A thief has to be against stealing. Otherwise, somebody will steal things from him. And he has been making so much effort to steal things from others. If others steal things from him, then what is the point? A thief will shout always, "Stealing is bad. Never steal, you will be thrown into hell." So nobody steals. Then the thief is free to steal. If nobody speaks untruth, then you can speak untruth and exploit people easily. If everybody speaks untruth, how can you exploit? Just think a society where everybody speaks untruth. And it is an accepted phenomenon that everybody speaks the lie. Then you will be at a loss. You will not be able to cheat people. Whatsoever you say, people will think you are a liar. Everybody speaks a lie here. Nobody can be deceived. So the liar has in his own interest to go on preaching morality, speak the truth, never steal, do this, do that. And from the back door he goes on doing just the opposite. This has to be understood. If right now somebody's pocket is picked, somebody steals, then many will be there shouting, "Catch the thief, kill the thief, who is there?" And many will shout, "Remember, the shouters just are showing one thing, that they are also thieves. By shouting, they are showing many things. One thing, that remember, I am not the thief, because I am so much against. Nobody should ever think or suspect me, because I am against all kind of such things. I am a moral person. Those who are pickpockets will shout more. And if the real pickpocket is caught, then the pickpockets will beat him to show to everybody that they are very much against it. This is a very, very complex phenomenon. A religious person is a totally different person. He will be able to forgive. He will be able to understand. He will be able to see the limitations of man and the problems of man. He will not be so hard and so cruel. He cannot be. His compassion will be infinite. Before we enter into these sutras, few things have to be understood. First, the concept of sin, the concept of the immoral act. What is immoral? And how we should define immorality? And what is the criterion? One thing is immoral in India, another thing is immoral in China. That which is immoral in India may be moral in Iran, and that which is moral in Russia may be immoral in India. There are 1,001 moralities. How to decide? And because now the world has become a global village, there is much confusion. What is right? To eat meat is right? Is it moral or immoral? The vegetarian says it is immoral. Many Jainas have many times come to me and said, what about Jesus eating meat? How can Jesus be an enlightened person and you say that he is enlightened? How he can be an enlightened person? He eats meat. For a Jaina, it is impossible to conceive that Jesus can be enlightened although he eats meat. Jainas have come to me and said to me, how Ramakrishna can be enlightened? He eats fish. He cannot be. Now they have a very definite criterion with them. Vegetarianism. One Jaina monk was talking to me and he said, I cannot believe that Jesus or Ramakrishna are enlightened. They eat meat. I told him, do you know, there are people in the world who think to drink milk is almost like eating meat, because it is animal food. Blood consists of two kinds of particles, two kinds of cells, red and white. Those red particles are separated in the mother's breast from the white, and the white particles become milk. Now milk is 50% blood. There are people in the world, real fanatics, who take things to their very extreme. They say milk cheese, butter are all animal foods. They have to be avoided. I asked the Jaina monk that Mahavir used to drink milk. What do you say? He was drinking blood. Was he enlightened or not? Now, Indian scriptures say milk is the purest food, sattvika. The most pure food is milk. It is not. It is blood. The Jaina monk started perspiring when he heard that milk is blood. And he said, what are you talking about? Milk is the sattvic food, the most purest food. But I said, this is the analysis, the scientific analysis. You prove it wrong. That's why when you drink milk, too much milk, your face starts becoming red. Blood is coming to you. That's why milk is so vital. And milk is 100% food. That's why children live only on the milk. It supplies everything. It supplies blood, it becomes your flesh, it becomes your skin, it becomes everything. Your bone, your marrow. It is pure blood. Now, how to decide who is right? There are 1001 moralities. If you go on deciding, you will be in difficulty. It will be impossible for you. You will go mad. You will not be able to eat. You will not be able to sleep. You will not be able to do anything. Now, there is a Jaina sect which is afraid of breathing. To breathe is immoral. Because with each breath, you kill many, many small living cells around you in the air. They are true. That's why the doctor has to use a mask so he does not go on inhaling things which are moving around, infections. That Jaina sect is afraid to breathe. Breathing becomes immoral. Walking becomes immoral. There are Jainas who don't walk in the night because you may kill something, an ant or something in the darkness. Mahavira never moved in the night. Never moved in the rainy season because then there are many more insects around. Movement becomes difficult. Breathing becomes difficult. If you go on looking around all the moralities, you will simply go crazy or you will have to commit suicide, but to commit suicide is immoral. If you listen to all kinds of moralities, that seems to be the logical thing, that just commit suicide. That seems to be the least immoral thing. One act and you are finished, then there will be no immorality. But that too is immoral. And when you commit suicide, you are not dying alone. Remember, it is not killing one person. You have millions of cells in the body which are alive. Millions of lives inside you which will die with you. So you have killed millions of people. when you fast, is it moral or immoral? There are people who say to fast is moral, and there are people who say to fast is immoral. Why? Because when you fast, you kill many cells inside, because they die out of starvation. If you fast, then 1 kilo weight disappears every day. You are killing many things inside you. 1 kilo weight disappears every day. Within a month, you will be just a structure of bones. All those people who used to live inside you, small people, they have all died. You killed all of them. Or there are people who say to fast is like eating meat. Now, very strange. And that is true. They have a logic in it. When 1 kilo weight disappears, where it has gone, you have eaten it. Your body needs that kind of food for every day. You go on replacing by outside food. If you don't replace it by outside food, the body goes on, because the body needs 24 hours, the body has to live. It needs a certain fuel. Then it starts eating its own flesh. To be in fast is to be a cannibal. These moralities can drive you mad. And you will not become a moralist. You will become moral and you will not become a moralist. The moralist is an ugly phenomenon. Now the sutras. Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives. He always used to go to the mountains. Whenever he will feel that his consciousness is becoming dusty, his mirror is covered by dust, he will go to the mountains in aloneness to cleanse his being, to cleanse his consciousness. It is like you take a bath, and after a bath you feel the body is fresh, young. Meditation is like an inner bath. To be alone for few moments every day is a must. Otherwise you will gather too much dust. And because of that dust, your mirror will not reflect anymore, or will not reflect rightly. It may start distorting things. Have you not watched? A single dust particle goes in your eye and your vision becomes distorted. The same is true about the inner vision, the inner eye. And so much dust goes on collecting. And dust comes from relationship. Just as you travel on a dusty road, you collect dust. When you move with people who are dusty, you collect dust. They are all throwing their dust all around. They are all throwing wrong vibes and they cannot do anything. They are helpless. I am not saying that condemn them. What they can do? If you go in a hospital and everybody is ill in the hospital, and if they are throwing their infections all around, they can't help. They breathe and the infection goes out. Have you not seen it when you go to the hospital to see somebody? Just 1 hour in the hospital and you start feeling a kind of sickness. And you had come perfectly healthy. Just the smell of the hospital. Just the faces of the nurses and the doctors. and the medical instruments and that particular hospital smell and people all ill and the whole vibe of illness and death always there. Somebody is always dying. Just 1 hour there and you feel very low. A kind of nausea arises in you. Coming out of the hospital, you feel a great relief. The same is the situation in the world. You don't know because you live in the world. The nurse who goes on working in the hospital and the doctor who goes on working in the hospital, they have to become insensitive, otherwise they will die. They will not be able to live there. They have become insensitive. They go on moving. That's why many times you see doctors look very, very insensitive. That is their protection. The patient goes on saying that this is wrong and that is wrong, and the doctor stands there almost not listening. The relatives of the patient go on running after the doctor and go on telling him that this is going wrong and that is, and he says, everything will be okay, I will come tomorrow morning. When I will come on my turn, I will see. Now you are feeling so concerned and he seems to be absolutely unconcerned. This is just to protect himself. If he becomes so sensitive, he will not be able to survive. He has to become hard. He has to create a kind of stoniness around himself. That stoniness will protect him. Will protect him from the hospital and the patients and the whole atmosphere. Doctors become hard. Insensitive. Nurses become hard, insensitive. The same is happening in the world at large. It is a kind of big hospital because everybody is ill here and everybody is on the deathbed and everybody is full of anger and violence and aggression and jealousy and possessiveness and everybody is false, pseudo, and everybody is a hypocrite. This is the world. You don't feel it. But when a Jesus moves amidst you, he feels it. Because he comes from the heights. He descends from the mountains. If you go to the Himalayas, and after living few days in the Himalayan freshness, when you come back to the plains, then you feel how dusty. How ugly, the vibe heavy. Now you have comparison. You have seen the fresh waters of the Himalayas, those fresh fountains running forever, and the crystal clear water, and then the municipal tap water. You have the comparison then. Only a meditator knows that the world is ill. Only a meditator feels that everything is wrong here. And when a meditator moves amidst you, naturally, much more dust he feels collecting on himself than you can feel because you have lost all sensitivity. You have forgotten that you are a mirror. You know that you are just a dust collector. Only a meditator knows that he is a mirror. So Jesus goes again and again to the mountains. Jesus went unto the mountains, unto the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning, he came again into the temple. And all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. And early in the morning, he came into the temple. Only when you have been to the mountains. And that does not mean that you have really to go to the mountains. It is not an outer phenomenon. The mount is within you. If you can be alone, if you can forget the whole world for a few seconds, you will regain your freshness. And only then you can go to the temple, because only then you are a temple. And only then your presence in the temple will be a real presence, and there will be a harmony between you and the temple. Remember, unless you bring temple to the temple, there is no temple. If you simply go to the temple and don't bring temple there within you, it is just a house. When Jesus goes into a house, it becomes a temple. When you go into a temple, it becomes a house, because we carry our own temples inside. Wherever Jesus goes, it becomes a temple. His presence creates that sacred quality. And only when you bring the temple and the freshness of the mountains and the virginity of the mountains, then only you can teach. You can teach only then when you have it. And early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. Now, Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou? This is one of the most important parables in Jesus' life. Go into it slowly, delicately, carefully. And the scribes and the Pharisees. Now you can read the moralists and the Puritans. In those days, those were the names of the moralists, the pundits, the scholars, the scribes, and the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the people who were very respectable. On their surfaces, very moral, pretentious, with great egos that we are moral and everybody else is immoral, and always searching and looking into people's faults. Their whole life is concerned with that, how to exaggerate our own qualities and how to reduce others' qualities to nil. The Puritans, the moralists, brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. Now, when you come to a man like Jesus, you have to come there in humbleness. You have to come there to learn something. You have to come there to imbibe something from Jesus. It is a rare opportunity. And now here come these fools, and they bring a woman. They bring their ordinary mind, their mediocre mind, their stupidities with them. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. They have not learned even the simple lesson that when you go to a man like Jesus or Buddha, you go to partake, to participate in his consciousness. You go to become intimate to him. You don't bring ordinary problems of life there. They are irrelevant. That will be wasting a great opportunity. That will be wasting Jesus' time. And he had not much time, as I told you before, only 3 years of ministry. And these fools were wasting like this. But they had a certain strategy in it. It was a trap. They were not really concerned with the woman. They were creating a trap for Jesus. It was a very diplomatic act. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery, and when they had set her in the midst, they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. Now, what is adultery? A conscious mind will say, if you don't love a man, maybe the man is your own husband. If you don't love the man and you sleep with the man, it is adultery. If you don't love the woman and she may be your own wife, if you don't love her and you sleep with her, you are exploiting her. You are deceiving her. It is adultery. But that is not the definition of the Pharisees and the Puritans and the scribes and the pundits. Their definition is legal. Their definition does not arise out of consciousness or love. Their definition arises out of the legal code. If the woman is not your wife, and you have been found sleeping with her, it is adultery. It is just a legal matter, technical. The heart is not taken into account, only the law. You may be deep in love with the man or with the woman, but that is not to be accounted. The unconscious mind cannot account higher things. He can account only the lowest. His problem is always legal. Is it your woman, your wife? Are you legally wed to her? Then it is good. Then it is no more sin. If she is not your woman, you are not legally wed to her, you may be in deep love and you may have immense respect for the woman. Almost you may be a worshipper of the woman, but it is sin. It is adultery. These people bring this woman to Jesus and they say unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. Just the other day, I was reading a memoir of an English Christian missionary who went to Japan in the early days of this century. He was taken around Tokyo. His host took him around to show him the city. In one public bath, there were men and women taking their baths in nude. The missionary was very much shocked. He stood there for 5 minutes, watched everything, and then he told to his host, is not it immoral? Women and men taking baths naked in a public place? And the host said, sir, this is not immoral in our country, but to stand here and watch is immoral. Sorry to say, he said, but I am feeling very guilty standing with you. Because that is their business. If they want to take a bath naked, that is their freedom. But why you are standing here? This is ugly, immoral. Now the missionary's standpoint is very ordinary. And the host's standpoint is extraordinary. These people say, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. And what you were doing there? These were peeping Toms, or what type of people were these? What you were doing there? Why you should be concerned? This woman's life is her life. How she wants to spend her life is her concern. Who are you to interfere? But the Puritan, the moralist, has always been interfering in other people's lives. He is not democratic. He is very dictatorial. He wants to manipulate people, condemn people. Now what these people were doing there? And they say, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. They have caught the woman while she was making love. One thing more, where is the man? She was doing adultery alone. Nobody has ever asked this question about this parable. I have read many Christian books, but nobody has ever asked, where is the man? But it is a man's society. It is always woman who is wrong, not man. The man will go perfectly well. He may be himself a Pharisee. He may himself be a respectable man. But the woman has to be condemned. Have you not observed it? Prostitutes are condemned. But where are the prostitutors? Where are those people? They may be the same people who condemn. Now Morarji Desai wants to bring prohibition to the country. And in his own ministry, out of 17, 12 are drunkards. 12. And he himself does not drink, that is true, but he drinks his own urine. That is a far worse case. But he wants to bring prohibition on the country. He wants to put by force. Maybe because he has not been drinking, he wants to take revenge on others or what? Puritans are always ugly people. They don't live, but then they don't allow anybody else to live. Their only joy is how to kill other people's joys. How to kill everybody's celebration. Now what these people were doing there, Don't they have anything else to do? Don't they have their own women to love? What kind of people are these? They must be a little pervert to go and searching and seeking who is committing adultery. And then where is the man? Just the woman has to be condemned always? Why the woman has to be condemned? Because the woman is a woman and the man is the dominant. And all the legal codes have been made by men. They are very, very prejudicial, biased. All the legal codes say what should be done to a woman if she is found in adultery, but they don't say anything. What should be done to the man? No, they say boys are boys. And boys will be boys. It is always a question of the woman. Even if a man rapes a woman, the woman becomes condemned. She loses respect, not the rapist. This is an ugly state of affairs. This can't be called religious. It is very political. Basically, in man's favor and against woman. And all your so-called moralities have been that way. In India, when a husband used to die, the wife has to go with him to the funeral pyre. Then only she is taught to be virtuous. She has to become a sati. She has to die with the husband. If she does not die, that means she is not virtuous. That simply means she wants to live without the husband. Or maybe she wanted the husband to die, now she wants freedom. Now she will fall in love with somebody else. In India, it has been thought that for the woman, there is no life once the husband is dead. Her whole life is her husband. If the husband is gone, she has to go. But nothing is said about man. If his woman dies, no prescription for him that he should die with the woman. No, that is no problem. Immediately the woman has died, in India it happens every day. The people are burning the woman and coming back home, and they start thinking about the new marriage, where the man should find a new woman, how to find. Not a single day is lost. For man, the morality is different. For woman, it is different. Then it is a very unconscious morality. And very immoral morality. My definition of morality is that of consciousness. And consciousness is neither man nor woman. Consciousness is just consciousness. Only when something is decided by your being conscious, it will be classless. It will be beyond the distinction and divisions of body, caste, creed. And only then it is moral. Master, they say, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou? This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground, as though he heard them not. This was the trap. They wanted to trap Jesus. Because Moses has said, that such a woman should be stoned. Nothing is said about the man. Such a woman should be stoned to death. Moses has said this. Now they are creating a problem for Jesus. If Jesus says, yes, do as Moses says, then they can accuse him. Because he has always been talking about love, compassion, kindness, forgiveness. Then they can say, what about your compassion? What about your forgiveness? What about your love? You said this woman has to be killed by stones? This is hard and cruel and violent. Tricky fellows. And if Jesus says, this is not right, Moses is not right, they can say, so you have come to destroy Moses? So you have come to destroy and corrupt our religion? And you have been saying to people that I have come not to destroy but to fulfill. What about that? If you have come to fulfill, then follow Moses' law. Now they are creating a dilemma. This is the trap. They are not much concerned about the woman, remember. Their real target is Jesus. The woman is just an excuse. And they have brought such a case, that's why they say, in the very act, red-handed. So it is not a question of deciding whether the woman has really committed. Otherwise, Jesus will have one excuse to get out. He will say, first try to find out whether really it has happened. Bring the witnesses. Let it first be decided. Then it will take years. So they say, red-handed, we have caught her. In the very act, we are all the witnesses. So there is no question of deciding anything else. And the law is clear that Moses says that such should be stoned. But what sayest thou? Do you agree with Moses? If you agree, then what about your love and compassion, your whole message? If you don't agree, then what do you mean when you say, I have come to fulfill? Then you have come to destroy Moses' law. So do you think you are higher than Moses? Do you think that you know more than Moses? But what sayest thou? This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him, but Jesus stooped down. Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground as though he heard them not. Why? Why Jesus stooped down? Why he started writing on the ground? They were just on the bank of a river. Jesus was sitting in the sand. Why he had started writing on the sand? What has happened? There is one thing to be understood. It is always a delicate problem. For example, if I see something stated by Buddha as wrong, there is a great hesitation to say that he is wrong. He cannot be wrong. Tradition must have misinterpreted. Something must have been wrongly put into his mouth. Buddha cannot be wrong. But now there is no way to decide, because the scriptures say this is clearly. Jesus hesitating. Jesus is concerned. He does not want to say a single word against Moses. But he has to say. Hence the hesitation. He does not want to say anything against Moses because Moses cannot say it that way. That is his inner feeling, that Moses cannot say that way. But the inner feeling cannot be decisive. These people will say, who are you and why should we care about your inner feeling? We have a written code with us, given by our forefathers. It is there written clearly. Jesus does not want to say anything against Moses because really he has come to fulfill Moses. Anybody who becomes enlightened in the world is always fulfilling all the enlightened ones that have preceded him. Even sometimes he says something against them, then too he is fulfilling them, because he cannot say anything against them. And if you feel that he is saying something against them, then he is saying something against the tradition, against the scriptures. But that looks like saying against Moses, against Buddha, against Abraham. Hence he stoops down. He starts looking on the sand and he starts writing. He is puzzled what to do. He has to find a way out. In such a way he has to find the way out that he has not to say anything against Moses, and yet he cancels the whole law. And really he comes with a very, very miraculous answer, magical answer. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. It is really incredible. It is beautiful. That was his hesitation. He has found a golden mean. He has not said a single word against Moses. And he has not supported Moses either. This is the delicate point to understand. Jesus was really utterly intelligent. Uneducated, but utterly intelligent. A man of immense awareness. Only that's why he could find the way out. He says, he that is without sin among you. He says perfectly right. Does not say directly that Moses is right, but he says perfectly right. If Moses says so, then it must be so. But then, who should start throwing stones at this woman? He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. So he starts. But only those who are without sin. Now this is a new thing that Jesus brings in. You can judge only if you are without sin. You can punish only if you are without sin. If you are also in the same boat, then what is the point? Then who is going to punish whom? And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Why again he stooped down? Because he must have been afraid that some foolish person is always possible. He knows that everybody has committed one sin or other. If they have not committed, they have been thinking to commit, which is almost the same. Whether you think or you act makes no difference. Remember, the difference between sin and crime is this. Crime has to be acted, only then it is crime. You can go on thinking. If you don't commit it to act, no court can punish you, because it never becomes a crime. And only crime is the jurisdiction of the court, not sin. Then what is sin? Sin is if you think, I would like to murder this man. No court can do anything. You can say, yes, I have been thinking my whole life. But thinking is beyond court's jurisdiction. You are allowed to think. No court can punish you because you dreamt that you killed somebody. You can dream every day. And you can go on killing as many people as you want. No court can catch hold of you. Unless it comes to actuality. Unless thought becomes thing. Unless thought is translated into reality. It comes out of you and affects society. Then it becomes crime. But sin it is. Because God can go on reading your thoughts. There is no need for him to read your acts. The magistrate has to read your acts. He cannot read your thoughts. He is not a thought reader or a mind reader. But for God, there is no difference. Whether you think or you do, it is all the same. The moment you think, you have done it. So Jesus says, he that is without sin among you, not without crime. He says, he is that without sin amongst you, let him first cast a stone at her. That distinction was known down the ages. That if you think, you have committed a sin already. And again he stooped down. Why this time? Because if he goes on looking at people, his very look may be provocative. If he goes on looking at people, then somebody just out of his look and his offense may throw a stone at the poor woman. He does not want to offend. He withdraws. He simply stoops down, starts writing on the sand again. As if he is not there, he becomes absent. Because his presence can be dangerous. If they have come just to trap him, and he is there, and they feel his presence, it will be difficult for them to feel their own consciences, their own consciousnesses. He withdraws into himself. He allows them total freedom to think about. He does not interfere. His presence can be interference. If he goes on looking at them, that will be offensive to their egos. And it will be difficult for them to escape either, because then it will feel bad that somebody was standing just in front of the mayor of the town or somebody, the respectable people. And how the mayor can escape and Jesus is looking. And if he escapes and does not throw the stone at the woman, it will be a proof that he is a sinner. He stoops down again. He starts writing on the sand, gives them a chance. If they want to escape, they can escape. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience. Jesus leaves them alone. That's the beauty of the man. He does not even interfere by his presence. He simply is no more there. Their own consciences starts pricking. They know. Maybe many times they have lusted after this woman. And maybe they themselves have been participants with this woman in the past. Maybe this woman is a prostitute. And all these respectable people in their turn have been making love to her. Because one prostitute means almost the whole town becomes involved. In India, in the ancient days, prostitutes were called Nagar Vadhus, the wife of the town. That is the right name. So these all people must have been involved in some way or other, with this woman or with other woman. If not in acts, then in thoughts. My feeling is it must have been the evening. And the sun is setting down. And it is becoming dark. And Jesus is writing on the sand. Is stooping down and it becomes dark. And by people start disappearing in the dark. and they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one. Beginning at the eldest, the mayor. Even unto the last. First the elders disappeared, because of course they have lived long, so they have sinned long. The young people may not be so great sinners. They have had not enough time yet. But the oldest disappeared first. Those who were standing in front, they must have moved slowly to the back. And then from the back they escaped. Because this man has created really a great problem. He has changed the whole situation. They had come to trap him and they are trapped. You cannot trap a Jesus or a Buddha. It is impossible. You will be trapped. You exist on a lower state of mind. How can you trap a higher state of mind? That is just foolish. The higher state can trap you immediately. Because from the higher state, your whole being is available. Now Jesus must have looked in these people's consciences. That was possible for him. He must have seen all kinds of sins raising heads. In fact, standing even there, they were thinking about the woman, how to get hold of her. Maybe they are angry because somebody else has committed the sin and they were not given the opportunity. Maybe they are only jealous. Maybe they wanted to be there instead of that man who has not been brought. Jesus must have looked from his height in their hearts. He has trapped them. They forget their trap completely. They forget about Moses and the law and etc. In fact, they were never worried about Moses and the law. This has also to be understood. They were really more interested in stoning this woman, enjoying this murder. Not that they were interested in punishing somebody who has committed a sin. That was just an excuse. They could not leave this opportunity of murdering this woman. And now Moses can be used. There are 1,001 things said by Moses. They are not worried about them. They are not interested in all those sayings and all those statements. They are interested in this, that Moses says you can stone a woman if you catch hold of her in adultery. They can't miss this great opportunity of murder, of violence. And when violence can be committed according to the law, who would like to miss it?